that begins this last leg. You know, we started Lent so long ago in this place on Ash Wednesday. We've gone through this Lenten journey. Some have been fasting, giving something up this time. Some have been trying to put in a new practice, a new spiritual discipline. Some have just been trying to focus more on prayer, on relationships. And we're getting so close to the end. We had a wonderful Palm Sunday service, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. It's the people shouting, "Hosanna, save us now." That almost demand to Jesus to save us because we are in need. That need to be saved was a big part of what Passover was all about. The connections between Passover and the Last Supper are strong, and in Mark's gospel, it is explicit. And while some scholars and historians debate over exactly the nature of what Jesus and his disciples might have been doing in this Passover supper, whether it looked like what we commonly know of, you know, as a modern Passover Seder, that's unclear. But what we do know is that the writer of Mark wanted us to make this connection between Passover and this meal. And so we sing that old African-American spiritual, "Go Down Moses," which is a recalling of those of that Exodus story, that Passover story. And we remember that on this night, it was a Passover meal that was connected to it. And it was Passover was that story that formed the Jewish people. It was a formative story in the life of the Hebrews. Without the Passover, you could say there would be no Jewish people. The Passover was led them out of Egypt. This was the story of God standing behind God's promise to Abraham. It was God standing next to Moses and standing behind the people that were slaves. It was a story of God standing against the greatest power the world had ever known, the Pharaoh. Standing against Pharaoh and saying, "No, your power is limited. Your power is not enough to hold my people." The story of the Passover is a story of God's saving act in the world to take God's people out of slavery and to deliver them from this bondage, from the sweat and the tears and the toil and the blood. It took them out of this place called Egypt and gave them a promised land. Gave them a kingdom, made them a nation, fulfilled those promises of Abraham that to make your nation great. Without the Passover story, there is no Jewish people. Without the Passover meal, there was no remembrance. The Passover meal was the family meal. It was the meal of a people that called them together, that represented this story. And a modern Passover Seder is full of symbolism. It is full, everything you do in a Passover Seder, everything you eat, everything that's read is full, it's rich, full of symbolism and connection to the story. It's a way to sit down and take some time and make sure that story is told to generation to generation. And in the meal, the people become their ancestors. It is they claim that right. And they relive the story of God saving the people. God saves the people through the Passover. And so here, Jesus sits with his disciples, sits when he knows that his time on earth was coming to an end, sits when he knows that the path that he has chosen, this path of God's will, is leading to a dark place. Gathered in Jerusalem during the Passover, when the people were expecting a Messiah to come and to lift them up out of the oppression of the Romans. You see, the power hadn't shifted as far as they were concerned. What once was Pharaoh was now Caesar. What once was Egypt was now Rome, and the people were in a similar place. They might not have been toiling as slaves, but they were surely under the oppression of a tyrant. Crosses lined the fields on a regular basis as Jews were crucified for speaking out, for rabble-rousing, for causing trouble, for stirring things up. And it's here and now when Jesus gathers with these disciples. And he had been in the business of rabble-rousing for the last few months or years. He had been in the business of stirring things up for a little while. He had been going around preaching this good news. And he'd been reaching out to women and children. And he had been reaching across to telling stories of where a Samaritan of all people is the hero. Where the hated stranger, the enemy, the Samaritan is the good one. And he's telling the people to do these crazy things, like if a Roman soldier hits you in the face on one side of the cheek, you should turn your other cheek to him as well. And he told them that if a Roman soldier compels you to walk a mile, that you should go with him too. He had these strange ideas about forgiving people, even on the Sabbath. About healing people, about caring about people's hearts instead of the letter of the law. See, the people had heard the story of how you live. They understood the system of hierarchy, the system of follow these laws, pay your dues, make sure that you don't cause trouble, pay tribute to the one that's above you in the system. It was a very structured society. And you know, Jesus was coming along saying, the first shall be last. Love your enemy. Pray for those who persecute you. He was healing widows' sons. He was loving tax collectors, eating with sinners, hanging around with women of ill repute. Lowly fishermen. And so he gathered with this ragtag bunch to have their family meal and to remember that God's saving act wasn't quite done. That story of God saving the people wasn't quite done. Finished. We're getting there. You see, we come to this story and it's often difficult to parse it out, to take it for what it is in the moment, in these segments. It's like if you've ever seen the movie The Sixth Sense, or any other movie by a film director, M. Night Shyamalan. He's famous for having these twist endings where you have this movie and you think everything is a certain way, and then right at the end, you realize that everything you thought was true wasn't true. And then to see, and it's usually pretty remarkable, and then you think, oh my gosh, all that stuff, now that makes now it makes sense, those strange things that were happening. Now that I know the ending, I can understand the beginning. And when you see the movie like The Sixth Sense, has anybody seen it? You know what I'm talking about? Okay, good. If you've seen this movie, you can't see it a second time and unsee the end. You can't. If you ever see it again, if you're flipping through and you see it on TNT, you can't unremember that the strange thing at the end is true. And so what we do here on Maundy Thursday is to try to remember, try to Try just for a moment to unsee the end of the story. Because it's impossible now as Christians to come to the table and to take the bread and the cup and unsee the end of the story. But and usually that's a good thing, but on this day we're invited to try to unsee it just for a moment. To remember that the struggle that it took to get there. That's what Thursday and Good Friday are all about. It's this chance to really dwell in it for a little while, to dwell in this difficult time, to dwell in this mystery of what's going on, why did all this happen, to dwell in just for a moment in the despair and the fear. To dwell for a moment in the garden with Jesus. In that moment where he is so sad he feels like he can die. To dwell there for a moment in that garden with Jesus as he prays for God to find another way. He prays to God in one of his most human moments to find a different way to save these people. To dwell for a moment at this table with the disciples, wondering, hearing this horrible news that one of their best friends is going to betray him. One of the 12, one that had walked with them for so long and they didn't know what was going on. Who could it be? It couldn't be me. And all of them questioning in their own hearts, wondering, well, it couldn't be me, could it? To dwell for a moment with the disciples as he predicts that one of them will deny him. And again, they're incredulous. They can't believe, no, I would never do that. And Peter, the strongest of them all, says, no way, I would never do that, Lord. It couldn't be me. To dwell in these nights, and these nights of wonder, of fear. It can get tiring to dwell in this time. Because all too often it's actually easy to dwell in the suffering. When you look at the world around you and you realize that the pain that can be crippling, when you look at the own loss in your life, as loved ones have departed, memories are bitter, as pain seems fresh every day, as worries about jobs or family or someone in your life that you care about is weighing down on you, it can get tiring in this garden. When you realize the outside world is pressing in. And we know that even at that table, that one of them was about to betray him. But what did Jesus do with this Judas? This one that he knew was going to betray him. This one that he knew, who knew was conniving something in his heart. This one who he knew was just didn't get it. You know, and we can posit a lot of reasons why Judas did what he did. It's a difficult thing to understand, and it's a fascinating thing in movies or in stories to develop this character of Judas and why. And there's all sorts of theories as to why Judas did what he did. Was it over money? Did he just want money? But here in the Gospel of Mark, the money is almost an afterthought. In the Gospels of John and Luke, it says Satan entered him, and then he did it. Well, so was he possessed? Was he not acting of his own accord? That seems to almost take some of the responsibility away from him. But what I get from Judas is that he was tormented. He was struggling, and temptation entered him. Temptation got the best of him. And whether it was because he wanted Jesus to take up arms, or whether he thought that Jesus wasn't acting quickly enough, or if he was mad because the woman had wasted all that money anointing his feet just a few a scene or two before, whatever it was that Judas was angry about, it got the best of him. It got the best of him. And what did Jesus do in response to this man? He broke bread with him. He called him to his table nonetheless. And the Gospel of Mark goes so far as to say that he says that when Jesus is identifying this man, it's the one that dips the bread with him. Implying he wasn't just there, he was sitting right next to him. He didn't just invite him to his table. He gave him the best seat. I think about when kids, when they come to the table, and how who they sit next to is so important. I want to sit next to Grandma. I want to sit next to my friend. I want to sit next to Rowan, Ellie says all the time. Or I want to sit next to Grandpa. I want to sit, and that, you know, they come to the table and they declare boldly, I want to sit next to, with joy and with hearts bursting, I want to sit next to him. And that's who Jesus wanted to sit next to. He came to that table, that family meal with the people that he'd loved, the friends that he had walked with, that he had taught. And in this last moment, when he knew that one of them was ready to betray him, had already done it, was plotting, just trying to find a time, Jesus said, I want to sit next to Judas. You see, it's easy to get angry with Judas and to wonder why and search for motivation and think, God, what a terrible man he must have been. I don't need to wonder about the motivation of Judas. I don't need to worry about what Judas's heart was because I've seen my own. I've seen my own. And I know what it's like to turn my back. And yet, I can find hope in knowing that Jesus invites me to that table and says, I want to sit next to Rob. And so we've come to this time. This garden time. And we've shared Jesus' meal, and we've sung the song of praise, and we've confessed our own sins. And yet this place, this place of darkness, this place can still be tiring. And Jesus came and found them sleeping. He said to Peter, Simon, are you asleep? Couldn't you stay alert for 1 hour? Stay alert and pray so that you won't give in to temptation. The spirit is eager, but the flesh is weak. Again, he left them and prayed, repeating the same words. And again, when he came back, he found them sleeping, for they couldn't keep their eyes open, and they didn't know how to respond to him. He came a third time and said to them, Will you sleep and rest all night? That's enough. The time has come for the human one to be betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let's go. Look, here comes my betrayer. And suddenly, while Jesus was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, came with a mob carrying swords and clubs. They had been sent by the chief priests, legal experts, and elders. His betrayer had given them a sign: arrest the man I kiss and take him away under guard. As soon as he got there, Judas said to Jesus, "Then they came and grabbed Jesus and arrested him. One of the bystanders drew a sword and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his ear. Jesus responded, 'Have you come with swords and clubs to arrest me like an outlaw? Day after day I was with you, teaching in the temple, but you didn't arrest me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled.' And all of his disciples left him and ran away. Later, when Peter was below in the courtyard, a woman, one of the high priest's servants, approached and saw Peter warming himself by the fire. She stared at him and said, 'You were with the Nazarene, Jesus.'
'I don't understand what you're saying.'
The female servant saw him and began a second time to say to those standing around, 'This man is one of them.' But he denied it again. A short time later, those standing around again said to Peter, 'You must be one of them, because you are a Galilean.'